Presumably, third phase will now go into the lexicon of euphemisms, alongside the CIA's, quote, to terminate with extreme prejudice, unquote. The fact that the operation was well known to the United States at least 5 years ago makes nonsense of its shocked surprise at the time of Letelier's death. One last thing, a comment that just made, I believe, on the regular broadcast show, which is that one of the things that was very important here in terms of trying to pass these Condor assassinations off on the left, and that's exactly what they were trying to do, was the aid of CIA and, in other countries, intelligence asset journalists. This is very important. And again, people like Claire Sterling, Michael Adine, William Buckley et al., with their intelligence connections, are invaluable in attempting to paint these killings. Again, basically death squad murders for hire of the cruelest and most calculated sort. And then the journalists jump in and try and paint these as being some kind of factional squabbles in the left. By the time the truth comes out, if it ever does, which in many cases it undoubtedly has not, it is relegated to the back pages of the newspaper. And another lie has been added to the claim of what exactly these various groups, terrorist groups, so-called, are involved with.
Okay, now basically, remember Otto Skorzeny, Muammar Gaddafi, Prince Borghese, and José López Rega, the whole crew there in the International Fascista? We're coming back to them in just a couple of minutes. Now, Otto Skorzeny is the person who obviously has weaved in and out of the pattern that we've been looking at. Skorzeny is in many ways one of the key people in having set the pattern for post-World War II terrorism, and this pattern was basically set during World War II when, as the chief of Hitler's commando operations, and in many ways the most dashing commando himself, most daring commando himself, he was one of Hitler's favorites, established a pattern by sort of formalizing a tactic which certainly was not new with Skorzeny, but which Skorzeny really sort of built into a more established principle than it had been. Skorzeny used terrorism in a military way during World War II. We're going to discuss Nazi methodology, Skorzeny's methodology, and its influence on post-World War II terrorism right now. Returning once again to the book Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield. Glenn Infield introduces his book by discussing Otto Skorzeny and the way in which he helped influence post-World War II terrorism. Infield writes, Otto Skorzeny not only played a role... Beginning again, Otto Skorzeny not only played an important role in Hitler's Third Reich, but also in the post-war world. In fact, he was the Hitler link to the present-day terrorism rampant around the globe. During the Third Reich, Skorzeny learned an important truth that he never forgot. An act of terrorism, committed by a minimum number of persons, is very often more effective than a large-scale, complex military operation. Terrorism, during the Third Reich and today, has been defined in various ways, and yet there is no universally accepted definition. The National Foreign Assessment Center of the Central Intelligence Agency defines international terrorism as, quote, the threat or use of violence for political purposes when such action is intended to influence the attitude and behavior of a target group wider than its immediate victims, and its ramifications transcend national boundaries. Skorzeny, as an SS Standartenführer, or a colonel with Section 6 of the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, Reich's Central Security Office, certainly used violence for political purposes, unquote, and transcended national boundaries, unquote. One of his most important assignments was to direct secret agents in foreign and neutral countries. Terrorist attacks, kidnappings, and assassination were standard operating procedure for him and the agents in his command. Hitler and Skorzeny understood that at times the military power of a country could be overcome if one man was dealt with. The German generals were unconvinced at first. They believed that the only way an opposing military power could be defeated was on the battlefield. Skorzeny's forays in Italy, Hungary, France, Denmark, and other countries changed their minds. It's another interesting little detail that I'm going to throw in here, sort of apocryphal, then we're going to go back and talk a little more about that statement before Nip reads to you some more. Interestingly enough, at the bottom of that page, in describing some of the influences Skorzeny has had on the post-war world, Infield writes, according to the confessed train robbers of the Glasgow to London night mail train, Skorzeny had financed the operation, which resulted in a take worth $7 million in the night of August 6, 1963. Those are the great, the very famous British great mail robbers that is a very, very famous case and something you read about quite a bit. Let's go back to the statement that Infield makes above here. Hitler and Skorzeny understood that at times the military power of a country could be overcome if one man was dealt with. The German generals were unconvinced at first. They believed that the only way an opposing military power could be defeated was on the battlefield. Skorzeny's forays in Italy, Hungary, France, Denmark, and other countries changed their minds. That phrase there is something that we're going to take a look at here in just a couple of minutes. Before doing that, I think it might be worth describing the Nazi tactic, the Nazi political philosophy in general as regards in relation to terrorism. Basically, the Nazis used a technique which they referred to as Schrecklichkeit, or frightfulness, translating it from the German. The word implies it means just about exactly what it implies. The idea is to be so terrifying and so ferocious that your enemies and would-be enemies will, for the most part, simply shy away from confronting you and grant you what you want simply out of fear of violence. Basically, if you establish yourself as being terrible enough, you can get a lot of what you want by intimidation. This is how the Nazis sought to operate, by being so evil and so intimidating that no one would dare to oppose them, and thereby they reduced the resistance which they felt they would reduce the resistance which they would come up against. Now, it's not too much of a jump from the phrase Schrecklichkeit, or frightfulness, to terrorism. It's really, they're very similar words and they're very similar concepts. As indicated in this passage from Infield, terrorism for our purposes here, and as Skorzeny discovered, is we might hold up as a demonstrable act of terror. In other words, you hold something up in the spotlight and show this as an example, and thereby hope to influence the behavior of others, the aforementioned target group that's mentioned in that CIA definition of terrorism. Let's go back to that. The threat or use of violence for political purposes, when such action is intended to influence the attitude and behavior of a target group wider than its immediate victims, and its ramifications transcend national boundaries. Skorzeny was very, very good at doing this, and his technique has become much more polished and has survived in grand fashion after the war. Of course, we've taken a look at Skorzeny's role in developing the Middle East security services and the Palestinian terrorists. We've taken a look in our Mediterranean merry-go-round series, and are going to review again in a second some of Skorzeny's connections to Italian fascism and Italian terrorism. So we see him as an individual who is very, very much involved with many of the post-war terrorist organizations and elements, and it's worth bearing in mind the techniques that he helped perfect during World War II. Now, Nip's going to read a passage here about one of the Skorzeny operations, and this is sort of typical, and it's the kind of thing that we're pointing to here. During the war, it should be remembered that a number of countries besides just Italy, Japan, and Germany fought on the Axis side. One of those nations, well, a number of them were in Eastern Europe. Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary also fought on the side of the Axis, as did Finland for a time. Now, near the end of the war, as the German armies were collapsing, Admiral Horthy, H-O-R-T-H-Y, I'm not absolutely sure on the pronunciation, but that's what we're going to call him for the time being, Admiral Horthy, H-O-R-T-H-Y, the head of state in Hungary, was having serious second thoughts about fighting on the Axis side. In fact, he was conducting secret negotiations not only with the Western Allies, but also with the Soviet Union as well. The long and the short of it is that Hungary was a fairly small and relatively powerless nation. Germany's defeat was assured, and what he was basically trying to do was to place some political currency in the bank for Hungary for the post-war world, as well as reducing the amount of losses that Hungary was taking on the battlefield, as well as, of course, forestalling the possibility or preventing the possibility of Hungary basically fighting a losing war across the length of its own territory with the resulting destruction. Because of this, Horthy was conducting negotiations with the Allies, both the United States and Britain, and also with the Soviet Union. Word got out about this to the Third Reich, to Hitler. Obviously, they were not at all pleased. Two solutions were being proposed, and this is by way of contrasting the Skorzeny method with the more conventional Nazi Schrecklichkeit method. There was an SS general named, he has a very long name, named Boxelewski. His title is longer than that, but Boxelewski was an SS general who basically proposed solving the proposed Hungarian defection by, as he put it, blowing the citadel off the Burgberg. That was the sort of the state house of Hungary where Admiral Horthy lived. And basically, the SS was going to move in a huge 650-millimeter artillery piece and just begin blowing the city of Budapest to pieces and the citadel, the state house of Hungary in particular. Skorzeny basically was more, what he decided to do was to kidnap Admiral Horty's son, Mickey Horthy. And Mickey Horthy, Nip's going to read you about him in just a second, but the contrast here is between the SS method of just leveling the city of Budapest and the Skorzeny method of kidnapping Horthy's favorite son, Mickey, and basically holding him as a sort of human ransom in order to oblige Horthy to reconsider his defection. The results of that, Nip's going to read you.
All right, and this is, again, from Infield's book on Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando. And reading. Skorzeny returned to the private home where he was staying. This is in Budapest. Where he was staying and discussed the situation with Radl and von Folkersam. There was no doubt in his mind that if the order came from Hitler to attack the Burgberg and occupy the citadel, he and his men faced a near impossible mission. Skorzeny was aware that Hitler had sent SS General Erich von dem Bach-Zaluski to Budapest to aid him, if he was needed. Bach-Zaluski was an expert in anti-partisan operations and was greatly admired by Hitler for his brutal but effective handling of the Warsaw Uprising. He had brought with him giant 650-millimeter mortar, and hours after arriving in Budapest, suggested to Skorzeny that they, quote, blow the citadel off the Burgberg. Skorzeny shook his head. Only as a last resort, he insisted. Bach-Zaluski had used the huge mortar to blast large sections of the city of Sebastopol on the Black Sea and to raise Warsaw. There was no question about the effectiveness of the weapon, but Skorzeny feared that use of it against the citadel on Burgberg would drive the Hungarians straight into the waiting arms of Stalin. He wanted to find a more subtle way to convince the regent to stay within the embrace of Hitler, and not order his Hungarian military forces to turn on the Wehrmacht. With the Russian 40th Army, the 7th Guards Army, and the 27th Army poised to attack Hungary from the Debrecen area, the Soviet 6th Tank Armies already fighting German and Hungarian troops in the Turda region, and Russian General I.M. Managarov's 53rd Army advancing from the town of Arad, any defection of Hungarian troops would be fatal to the German positions. It was a delicate situation, one that required a political operation rather than a military attack on the Hungarian government stronghold with Bach-Zaluski's 650-millimeter mortar. Yet, it became increasingly clear to Skorzeny that if he was to prevent Horthy from signing an armistice with the Allies, he had to act promptly. On September 22nd, he learned that a representative of the Hungarian government, Colonel General Nadai, had flown to Naples to meet with British and American representatives concerning the occupation of Hungary by their forces prior to the takeover of the country by the Soviets. The fact that this mission failed wasn't much encouragement to Skorzeny, because a few days later he learned that a special delegation of Hungarians under the leadership of General Gábor Farago was in Moscow trying for the second best solution to the Hungarian problem, an armistice with Russia. In addition, Skorzeny managed to obtain a copy of a letter sent by Hungarian prisoners of war in Russia to General Béla Miklós, commander of the 1st Hungarian Army. The letter pleaded with Miklós to abandon the Germans and join with the Soviet military forces in attacking the Wehrmacht troops, pointing out that Nazi Germany was being defeated militarily, would soon collapse politically, and that every other satellite except Hungary had already broken with Hitler and was fighting the German troops. Miklós was the most respected military commander in Hungary. If he threw in his lot with the Russians, it would be a serious blow for the Third Reich. Decisive action was imperative immediately, Skorzeny decided. The question was, what type of action? A conversation with Edmund Wiesenmeyer, Ribbentrop's aide in Budapest, gave Skorzeny his initial idea on how to handle the ticklish predicament. Wiesenmeyer remarked that the problems were piling up in the Hungarian-German controversy, adding that now even Horthy's son was involved. That was the first Skorzeny had heard about the son's part in the problem. "What do you mean?" he asked Wiesenmeyer. "Most people think Mickey Horthy is only interested in blondes and good wine," Ribbentrop's aide explained, "but actually he does more than throw wild parties and sleep with beautiful women." "Such as?" "Well, right now he has been meeting with representatives of Yugoslav partisan chief Tito, talking about an armistice with Russia. Tito is acting as a go-between." Skorzeny, aware of Mickey Horthy's reputation, wasn't convinced. "I can't believe Admiral Horthy would rely on Mickey. He's caused the old man too much trouble in the past." Wiesenmeyer laughed. "That he has, but ever since Horthy's oldest son, Eastman, was killed when his plane was shot down on the Russian front, Mickey has been his father's pride and joy. Besides, we have proof of the meetings. Mickey met with the Yugoslavs in a villa in the suburbs of Budapest yesterday, and they are scheduled to meet again on October 15th. "And the old man is proud of Mickey?" "Very much so," Wiesenmeyer said. Skorzeny was acquainted with Milos Miki Horthy, having met him in Vienna several times. The young, dark-haired, and good-looking playboy had never seemed to take either politics or the war seriously, and consequently Skorzeny had never considered him as an important figure in the Hungarian crisis. But Wiesenmeyer's remarks had changed his opinion. If, As Wiesenmeyer stated, Admiral Horthy had so much confidence in Mickey that he permitted him to negotiate with Tito's representatives, then perhaps Mickey could also be a valuable asset to the Third Reich. If Mickey Horthy were in Third Reich hands, would Admiral Horthy give up his plans to abandon Hitler to get his son back safely? Skorzeny decided it was worth a try. Investigation showed that the meeting between Mickey Horthy and Tito's representatives was scheduled for Sunday, October 15th, on the second floor of a building not far from the Danube. Skorzeny made his plans carefully, fully aware that while Mickey was attending the meeting as the sole representative of the Hungarian government, he would be well protected. Skorzeny arranged for two of his officers to rent an apartment on the third floor of the same building, and he had several of his commandos in the apartment when the secret meeting began. Von Felkersam was positioned with a contingent of commandos out of sight of the building, but only moments away from the front entrance. Skorzeny placed several commandos dressed in civilian clothes in a nearby park, while other commandos patrolled the street in front of the building in the uniforms of German Army Feldgendarmen, military police. A minute after Mickey's arrival, Skorzeny, in the guise of Dr. Wolf, drove his automobile slowly down the street in front of the building where the meeting was being held, eased it into a parking spot directly in front of a Hungarian army truck, and got out. Very casually, and without even glancing at the building, he walked around to the front of his car and opened the hood. The sound of the hood being opened aroused the curiosity of the Hungarian soldiers hidden in the back of the truck under a heavy canvas cover. One of the soldiers pulled a corner of the canvas back and looked out. During the seconds the canvas was open, Skorzeny saw three machine guns in the truck. However, the Hungarian soldiers were convinced that Skorzeny was merely a civilian driver having trouble with his car, and they pulled the canvas back over their heads. Concealed by the hood of his car, Skorzeny glanced toward the park. Several additional Hungarian soldiers were walking back and forth in the park as though out for a morning stroll. Skorzeny noted they were heavily armed. It was obvious Mickey Horthy was not going to be kidnapped without a fight. He looked at his watch. Approximately 5 minutes had elapsed since the meeting began, the deadline he had set for the attack. At that moment, the commandos in the apartment above Horthy and the Yugoslavs were supposed to be on their way down the stairs to the secret meeting place. As Skorzeny prepared to walk toward the building, he saw the commandos disguised as military police dart through the front door of the meeting place. The Hungarian soldiers in the truck saw them too. They opened fire with their machine guns, and the last commando of the group fell face down in the foyer. At the sound of the shots, the Hungarian soldiers in the park raced toward the scene. Skorzeny put his whistle to his mouth and blew the signal for Von Felkersam to bring his contingent of commandos to join the battle. Skorzeny barely had time to dive behind his Mercedes before the Hungarian soldiers opened fire. He was pinned down behind the car for several minutes while machine gun bullets pierced doors and shattered the glass of the windows. Before he was wounded, however, Von Felkersam and his force arrived and drove the Hungarian soldiers back from the truck to the entranceway of the building next to where Mickey Horthy and the Yugoslavs were meeting. Skorzeny was able to escape from behind his Mercedes during the retreat of the Hungarian soldiers. As he was running toward the building where the meeting was taking place, he glanced toward the entranceway, where the Hungarian soldiers were taking refuge. The sight that greeted him made him stop in his tracks. Another large group of Hungarian soldiers who had evidently been hiding in the building were now struggling to get out. "Don't let them get into the open," he called to Von Felkersam. Taking a hand grenade from the commando nearest him, Skorzeny hurled it toward the doorway. It was an excellent throw, because the grenade landed between two marble pillars supporting the impressive-looking entrance to the building, and when it exploded, both pillars crumbled. Leaves of the portal and several slabs of marble fell on the Hungarian soldiers standing in the entrance. Those who retreated into the building were trapped inside by the debris that completely blocked the doorway. Several of the commandos also tossed grenades into the building, and the resultant blast completely trapped the Hungarian soldiers. "Let's get upstairs," Skorzeny bellowed as he took the steps two at a time. On the first landing, he met several of his commandos coming down. They had four prisoners, one of whom was Mickey Horthy. The young Horthy was struggling and cursing. Skorzeny, who wanted to get away from the scene as fast as possible, with as little commotion as possible, grabbed a rug from the floor and tossed it to the commandos. "Wrap him in the rug." The commandos threw Mickey Horthy to the floor and quickly rolled him inside the rug. They then grabbed the rug and hurried down the stairs and out the door to the waiting van. The rug, with Mickey Horthy hidden inside, was tossed into the van. "Get him to the airport. I'll follow," Skorzeny yelled. He trailed the van for 3 blocks when he suddenly saw a sizable force of Hungarian soldiers double-timing up a side street toward the scene of the kidnapping. Skorzeny knew von Filkersam had not yet had time to get his commandos out of the area and would be trapped. Quickly, he swerved his bullet-riddled Mercedes into the path of the oncoming Hungarian troops. When the officer in charge angrily came to the side of the Mercedes, Skorzeny, acting like a scared tourist, said, "You better wait here a while. Everyone back there is running around in confusion. No one seems to know what is going on. If I were you, I would check closely before you walk into a trap." The Hungarian officer hesitated and nodded his head. He ordered his men to stay in position while he called headquarters. While the officer was at the telephone, Skorzeny turned his car around and drove off, knowing that von Filkersam would most surely have cleared the area safely by this time. Driving full speed, he caught up to the van with Mickey Horthy in it just as it pulled into the airport. He helped load the rug and the still-struggling Mickey Horthy into the waiting plane. "Get him to Vienna as fast as possible," he told the pilot. Should just mention, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
Okay, now that basically will serve as a paradigm. Obviously, it's not something that is altogether remarkable, particularly to contemporary audiences. We've seen political kidnappings of various types. That's sort of, by the way, the postscript to that, although he vacillated for a while longer, Admiral Horthy eventually reneged on his agreement to go over to the Allied side. Hungary fought on till the bitter end and suffered quite a bit, obviously, as a result. But that effort on the part of Skorzeny was successful. By kidnapping Miki Horthy, he was eventually able to swing Admiral Horthy back to the Axis side. That was the key element, although Horthy did vacillate for a while longer. Eventually, Skorzeny's ploy was successful, and Skorzeny and his men stormed the Bergberg itself, and Skorzeny was actually more or less acting head of state of Hungary for a period of time. That event and those types of things are the things that Skorzeny turned into something of a science. Demoralizing an army by assassinating its general. At one point, he was involved in a plot to assassinate Eisenhower. He was also going to kidnap Marshal Pétain of France when he began vacillating at one point. Also, there was an unsuccessful attempt on the life of Tito, the head of the Yugoslavian partisans. But this is the type of thing that Skorzeny perfected and of which he became a master. And obviously it's something that we've seen a great deal today. And that's worth noting because of Skorzeny's intimate contact with so many of the terrorist groups which have evolved today, such as the Palestinian terrorists that he helped form while working under the Galen contingent for CIA and so forth. Returning to Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield. And in the conclusion, Infield also sort of sums up Skorzeny's influence on modern-day terrorism. Skorzeny's actions during and after the Third Reich had a serious impact on history, perhaps second only to that of Adolf Hitler, although he was not nearly as well known. Hitler set policy during the Third Reich, but he had to depend upon others to carry these policies out. Otherwise, the effect of his decrees and policies would not have been important. Skorzeny was Hitler's choice for shouldering the responsibility of commando terrorism. Hitler set policy for 12 years. Skorzeny committed, planned, and taught others terroristic actions for those 12 years, plus 30 additional years. It was Skorzeny who was responsible for the continuity of Nazi terrorism during the post-war years and for the extension of Hitler's Third Reich policies around the globe. It has become evident during recent years that major wars in this nuclear age will be fewer than in the past, but individual and group terrorism will increase steadily. Skorzeny and his commandos during the Third Reich and Skorzeny and his Odessa members during the post-war years were leaders in modern-day terroristic tactics. Skorzeny's followers and students adhere to his teachings today. The students in terror, by the way, in this next section, Infield is simply talking about the methodology which Skorzeny used, not implying that these following groups necessarily had any direct contact with Skorzeny, although some of them did, as we're going to look at. The students in Tehran, when they stormed the American embassy in 1979 and held U.S. employees hostage, used a technique that Skorzeny used in Hungary during World War II when he stormed the Bergberg in Budapest and held the Hungarian regent Admiral Milos Horthy hostage. The legendary Entebbe raid by the Israelis in 1976 brought back memories of Skorzeny's rescue of Mussolini 33 years earlier. Secrecy, daring do, and surprise brought the more than 200 hostages out of Uganda, just as it brought Mussolini off the peak of the Gran Sasso. The kidnapping and murder of former Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro in 1978 was reminiscent of the fate of Hubert Kukurs in South America when Kukurs broke the unwritten law of secrecy of the Odessa and revealed the hiding place of Josef Mengele. These and similar incidents of violence and terror have roots in the Skorzeny technique. A quick rundown of the major terrorist and guerrilla organizations which use commando tactics today reveal that Skorzeny was directly or indirectly involved with most. The IRA? Skorzeny spent considerable time in Ireland during the post-war years, advising the leaders of this organization, and many of their actions follow Skorzeny pioneered tactics. The PLO? Skorzeny advised both the Al-Fatah and PLO while he was in Cairo, involved with the Nasser regime, and was well acquainted with Yasser Arafat. The Baader-Meinhof group, despite having a different ideological approach to the world situation, benefited by adopting several Skorzeny techniques such as kidnapping and political disruption. The Black Liberation Army, the Symbionese Liberation Army, and the Weather Underground took encouragement from the Third Reich techniques of Hitler's commando chief and copied them, consciously or unconsciously, when the situation was similar. And at the very conclusion of the book, Enfield writes, "Terrorism, the Skorzeny syndrome, is flourishing in the modern world, a reminder that Hitler and Nazism are still taking their toll more than three decades after the Third Reich collapsed. The most dangerous man in Europe in 1944, Scarface Skorzeny from Vienna, made certain of that. It is said he died with a smile on his face. If so, was it because he knew the terrorism he left behind would continue after him?" And again, many of those groups, notably the IRA, of course the Palestinian commandos and Al-Fatah, as we looked at, had direct contact with Skorzeny. Many of the others essentially borrowed the tactics which he perfected. Although he didn't invent them, he perfected them and I guess you could say raised them to something of a level of a science. So Skorzeny is really, it perhaps would not be too much of an exaggeration to refer to him as the godfather of terrorism. Certainly a person whose influence on the modern world is much, much greater than generally suspected. Most people have never heard the name. He really appears to be one of the key people shaping the scene today, even though he's gone as of 1975. I think Enfield's comparisons and obviously the contact with groups like IRA and Al-Fatah and so forth are critical.
And also, the point has to be also that despite what the general tone of Mr. Enfield's summation, which was, as Dave mentioned, largely, which were very strong, and in fact, he was, I think you would have to say, one of the founding members and certainly one of the leading lights of International Fascista. And we look at, for example, Operation Condor and the vast array of national governments that sprang out of that particular or that combined in that operation and the terrorist acts that sprang out of it, that being only one. Look at all the European fascist organizations involved, the Native American groups that are involved with International Fascista through the World Anti-Communist League. You would have to say that Skorzeny's actual hands-on influence is worldwide. And when you look at these particular groups working with other groups like the Red Brigades and the IRA, which as we have examined in the past and will continue to examine and even we'll talk about a bit, I believe, tonight, you see that, in fact, Skorzeny's influence was a very much a practical and actual as well as a spiritual.
Yeah, we're going to talk some more about Skorzeny's direct influence upon some of these groups. One of the aspects of terrorism which we're going to be discussing right now, we'll be reviewing the material on the International Fascista that Nip just read a few minutes earlier, about an hour or so ago. Anyway, they will be reviewing the International Fascista passages from Great Heroin Coup here. One of the aspects of terrorism, and again, we're going to be highlighting the Skorzeny methodology here, is suicide attacks. Now, so-called kamikaze missions became most widely publicized during World War II in connection with the Japanese kamikaze, the Divine Wind, the pilots who dove their airplanes into Allied ships, all usually loaded with explosives. It's worth noting that Otto Skorzeny was a key developer of various so-called suicide weapons. Now, in recent years, we've seen such things as driving trucks or boats or airplanes full of explosives into various targets. The suicide commandos thereby sacrificing their own lives. This is something which may look sort of strange to a lot of people. In fact, the use of suicide weapons is something that Otto Skorzeny was instrumental in developing, and one of the people who also worked on suicide weapons and during World War II worked with Skorzeny on these weapons was none other than Giusto Valerio Borghese, the key Italian fascist we looked at in the Mediterranean merry-go-round and who was a key participant with Skorzeny in the International Fascista along with Muammar Gaddafi, who's using a lot of these suicide squad tactics today. And again, it looks very strange to a lot of people, these people driving trucks into the marine compound and blowing it up and so forth. Of course, the whole question of mind control is something that has to be considered. It may be a lot easier to recruit someone for that kind of a mission in the age of mind control, But we're going to take a look at Skorzeny, Borghese, their association with Gaddafi, and their role in developing suicide weapons, which in turn are a key feature of the terrorist scene today. And by the way, the suicide weapons in the context of the book called Suicide Squads, so actually I'm not sure if it's called Suicide Squads or Weapons, anyway, the O'Neill book that will be featured front and center in the tape segment you're about to hear, defines suicide weapons as any weapon in which the operator's chance of return is considered so slight that he better not count on it. It's sort of a subjective thing. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to dive the plane or the ship into the side of the target, but it's one in which basically you didn't sign on it if you wanted to come back. Your return wasn't seen as being very likely. And from that standpoint, it obviously they would prefer you to return, but you were basically counted out once you left on the mission. This next tape segment that you're going to hear, it'll describe at considerable length not only suicide weapons, but also the roles of Otto Skorzeny, Giusto Valerio Borghese, and nowadays, their associate in the Internazionale Fascista Muammar Gaddafi's development of same. This particular Hard Rain show was actually one of the last in that series. This is from late summer of 1984. So this is just a couple of years ago.
All right. And you are listening, of course, to Radio Free America on KFJC.
Now, during the course of that half hour, what we're going to be looking at is the development of suicide squads. Now, there's been a lot of emphasis in the news media recently on suicide attacks, these stemming primarily from the successful attacks on U.S. installations in Lebanon, the two bombings of U.S. embassies, and the attack on the Marine compound in the fall of 1983. Now, suicide squads generally are associated with the Japanese kamikaze of World War II. These were units developed by Japan in which primarily flyers but also Japanese sailors would climb into airplanes or boats filled with explosives and crash themselves into American and Allied shipping in order to basically forestall and hopefully eventually prevent the invasion of Japan, at least according to the aspirations of the Japanese General Staff. The development of suicide squads, however, is much, much broader than just the use of the use by the Japanese, of such units in the Pacific. Now, what we're going to be looking at today are the development of suicide squads during World War II, and specifically we're going to tie to the key figures involved in developing suicide weapons, a fellow named Borghese and another one named Skorzeny, into the Internazionale Fascista. That's a combine of far right-wing elements dedicated to turning the world fascist, and specifically, the Internazionale Fascista has been centrally involved in terrorism over the last 15 years, and specifically, the Internazionale Fascista goes out of its way to disguise its terrorist acts as basically violence of the left. And we're going to be looking again at Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese and Otto Skorzeny, two key members of the Internazionale Fascista, also very much involved with the development of suicide squads. Now, the first chapter, I guess you could say, in the historical development of suicide squads in World War II that we're going to be looking at concerns the aforementioned Commander Giusto Valerio Borghese, last name B-O-R-G-H-E-S-E. Now, during World War II, Borghese commanded something called the 10th Light Flotilla of the Italian Navy. Now, what this was an Italian naval unit which used light craft, primarily submarines, manned torpedoes, and explosive motorboats in order to combat Allied shipping, primarily the British in the Mediterranean, although there were some missions planned against the United States. Now, the first thing we're going to take a look at here concerns Prince Borghese's role in planning a suicide attack by midget submarines known as the CA series on New York harbors. The information for the program today, most of the information, comes from a book called Suicide Squads, authored by a man named Richard O'Neill, formerly of the British Navy. And O'Neill's Suicide Squads is published in soft cover copyrighted by Salamander Books Limited of Great Britain. It's copyrighted in 1981 and distributed in the United States by Ballantine Books. Okay, so it's copyrighted by Salamander Books, distributed in the U.S. by Ballantine. And again, Suicide Squads is authored by a former British Navy man named Richard O'Neill. In his book, O'Neill describes the proposed mission against New York Harbor by Borghese. What this would have involved was a
small Italian midget submarine of the CA class, which was going to be carried to New York on a larger Italian submarine, rather. And then the midget submarine was going to detach itself and conduct operations against American shipping in New York Harbor. And again, this was a suicide mission because the possibility for return for the CA submarines was held so low. In this book, in Suicide Squads, Richard O'Neill describes a suicide mission as one in which the crewmen or crewmen carrying it out had no practical, had no reasonable expectation of returning. Okay, that's how he defines suicide missions. It wouldn't necessarily have involved a mission in which the people would crash themselves in, the soldiers or sailors or airmen would crash themselves into enemy installations as the suicide bombers in the Lebanon attacks did, but the suicide mission is described as one in which the person carrying it out cannot reasonably expect to survive, and this definition fit very well the midget submarine raids which Borghese was planning against the American coast. O'Neill writes as follows. Date December 1943. Place Hudson River, New York, USA. Attack by Italian midget submarine CA-2. Target, shipping at anchor and dock installations. Urged on by the German High Command, who stressed the moral effect on the Allies of increased Italian naval effort in the Atlantic, Commander Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese, commanding the 10th Light Flotilla, planned spectacular and potentially suicidal missions for the Italian midgets. Attacks on the British base at Freetown, Sierra Leone on the west coast of Africa, and on harbors all along the east coast of the United States. The Freetown plan, for which CA-1 was allocated, was abandoned when it was decided that British defensive measures allowed no chance of success. But the operation against the USA, with New York specified as the target for maximum psychological effect, reached an advanced planning stage. In mid-1942, in preparation for the New York raid, CA-2 was transported overland to Bordeaux, where Beta Somme headquarters for Italian submarines operating in the Atlantic, was commanded by Captain Enzo Grossi. There, too, came the Marconi-class submarine Leonardo da Vinci of 1,190 tons, selected as the midget's carrier. Under the direction of Commander Borghese and Sub-Lieutenant Massano, Italian workshops at Bordeaux under Major Fenu removed Da Vinci's 3.9-inch gun and in its place, just forward of the conning tower, constructed a semi-recessed pouch with retaining shackles for CA-2. Recall that the CAs, designated 1, 2, 3, and 4, were Italian midget submarines for suicide missions. Continuing here with O'Neill's account, this arrangement led to the mother boat being designated the Kangaroo. Sea trials under Borghese's command proved to his satisfaction that the midget could be launched from the submerged Kangaroo and could be recovered when the mother boat surfaced beneath it. The latter point was important in avoiding any indication that the projected mission was regarded as suicidal. Just so had the Imperial Japanese Navy made official, unquote, plans to recover its midgets after Pearl Harbor. According to Borghese, the Kangaroo would launch its midget while submerged off New York Bay. CA-2, or in the later stages of the operational planning, the near-identical CA-3 or 4, would make its way by night into the crowded harbor at the mouth of the Hudson. Two of the three crewmen in frogmen's gear would leave the boat to plant time-fused explosive charges. 8 220-pound charges and 20 4.4 limpets were carried under ships and against dock installations. Then CA-2 would slip downriver to make rendezvous at sea with the Kangaroo. The suicidal nature of the plan is obvious. Borghese made the airy assumption that New York's harbor defenses, quote, against such a surprise attack presumably didn't exist, unquote. Although the happy time, unquote, enjoyed by German U-boats off the American East Coast in the earlier part of 1942 had resulted in much improved anti-submarine patrolling. The Kangaroo would have to surface in American coastal waters to allow the midget's crew to enter their craft since they had no means of access from the mother boat. And it would have to surface again offshore in the aftermath of the attack to retrieve the midget. Finally, it was estimated that the midget itself, with a submerged capability for CAs 2, 3, or 4 of no more than 70 nautical miles, might need to remain in the Hudson for up to 2 days. Yet, according to Borghese, only Italy's collapse in September of 1943 prevented the mission from being carried out as planned in December of that year. So again, Commander Giusto Valerio Borghese, commander of the 10th Light Flotilla, which used a number of different modes of suicide squads, was involved in planning a suicide attack, a kamikaze attack, if you will, via midget submarine on New York Harbor in 1943. Now, Borghese's 10th Light Flotilla, in addition to midget submarines, also used something called manned torpedoes, which were just what their name implied. It was basically a torpedo piloted by a sailor who then sailed the torpedo into the ship, the enemy ship. They also, the 10th Light Flotilla, also used explosive motorboats, or EMBs, and those are going to figure very prominently in the discussion in just a minute. Also, Borghese was involved in the use of underwater infantry, that is, squads of frogmen, scuba divers, who were used in a military capacity, primarily for demolitions. Now, after Italy surrendered, Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese continued to work for the Axis cause. He was a dedicated fascist and did not surrender to the Allies along with the bulk of the Italian forces. After the surrender of Italy, what Borghese did was to jump basically to Nazi Germany, where he began working with, among others, Otto Skorzeny of the SS. He was an SS colonel involved with overseeing all German commando training, and Skorzeny was very much involved also with the development of suicide squads, and Borghese trained Skorzeny's commando units in the use of, among other things, the EMBs, which his own, that is Borghese's own 10th Light Flotilla, had used to good effect. The EMBs, recall, are explosive motorboats which were crashed into enemy craft and then exploded, hopefully, according to the pilots, sinking the enemy craft. And Borghese used his expertise with the EMBs and communicated that to Otto Skorzeny. And Skorzeny was very much involved with the development of something called the Linsen, which is German for lentil. And those were the German EMBs, or explosive motorboats. And it's important to note here that both Borghese and Skorzeny were working together on suicide squads, on the development of suicide weapons during World War II, because we're going to see the two of them cooperating in the Internationale Fascista after the war in just a couple of minutes. Of the cooperation between Skorzeny and Borghese on the development of suicide explosive motorboats during World War II, O'Neill writes as follows. The inspiration for the EMBs used by German forces during World War II came directly from the Italian Navy's MTM boats described earlier in this chapter. After Italy's surrender in September of 1943, some members of the 10th Light Flotilla, notably Commander J. Valerio Borghese and Lieutenant Eugenio Walk, W-O-L-K, remained loyal to the Axis cause. The services of these veterans were at first denied to the German Navy by SS Sturmbannführer Otto Skorzeny, who quickly preempted them to instruct his own commando force recruited largely from within the SS. It was at first intended that SS personnel and naval volunteers for special weapons, unquote, should train together. However, a number of the SS men were from punishment units. They had been persuaded to volunteer for hazardous duties with the promise that their crimes would be forgotten if they survived. Most naval officers made no secret of their reluctance to work with such individuals. Thus, the first EMB operations were carried out by Skorzeny's commandos, who trained at Lagenargen near Friedrichshafen on the north shore of Lake Constance. Their sorties against Allied shipping in the Tyrrhenian Sea off the Anzio-Nettuno beachheads went almost unnoticed. So again, Skorzeny and Borghese working together on suicide boats during the Second World War.